Okay, good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Discussion Net, courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 repeater. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. My name is Brett, and I'm net control for today, June 9th. That's Tuesday, June 9th, for those people who are retired, 2020. And so, coincidentally, we meet each Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz.
Kilo Echo 7, Oscar Levy Uniform with a comment.
Okay, good. Like to discuss this because basically, yeah, there was also news today that the World Health Organization was kind of chastised about their, you know, they had never really mentioned the asymptomatic spreaders as being something to be concerned about, but there have been studies that shown that they do exist and they're there, and as we gather the information, we are finding more information out, and so they, you know, that person, I'll let these guys say that, but the controversy is there that, yes, oh, all of a sudden we're starting to pay attention to this, and, you know, what we said before, you know, well, we don't know. We still haven't proved it, you know, so the question is, do you, you know, take the stance that it's not just because we don't know we shouldn't mention it, or should we, you know, mention the preliminary data when it's, you know, not proven yet. But go ahead. We'll start with Richard with his comment, and then we'll go to Paul. Okay, good. Paul, what did you hear about this?
Mine was the same as Richard's, that World Health Organization representative was at a conference and made the statement, and then later this afternoon she's walked back that claim and said, well, it wasn't quite, I didn't say quite what I meant, that the wording wasn't quite right, and that she's basically retracting the statement from earlier, KE7OLU.
Yep, KG7GDB. So, again, I think that the you can't say it doesn't happen. You know, it does seem to happen, but they've confused it. We don't really have a way of testing this. Okay, part of it, again, our testing, you know, policies are so variable that you know, we really don't know even how to measure it. Okay, so if I can just tell you as a scientist, you know, try to think of an experiment where you'd say, okay, I want to find out how many people are asymptomatic and are, you know, carriers of the COVID. And then the second part of that question is, and if they're carriers, are they infectious? Okay, now Sheila had mentioned this before. Obviously, if you're showing symptoms, if you're, you know, the kind of breathing that you're doing, if you're coughing and you're spreading, you know, more material around, you know, you're more likely to spread the illness than if you're, you know, not showing symptoms. You know, so just from the physical act of you know, respiring and versus coughing, you know, a person who's calm is not showing symptoms is less likely to spread the particles, you know, as someone who is, you know, actively coughing really badly. On the other hand, if you're asymptomatic, you know, a person who's sick is probably staying home or in quarantine or has gone for treatment, whereas someone who's not is basically walking around and, you know, potentially spreading the illness. So the question really is, how do you find those people? That's the problem. And, you know, in order to find them, you would have to test them, and you'd have to, and so you have to kind of test everybody and then find out whether, you know, what we thought before is that someone who's test negative, you know, well, they don't have it. You might be exposed, you say, and we might wait 14 days, and if they still don't get it, we just assume that they didn't get it. But some people just don't get the symptoms. So then, you know, you really should probably retest them again. So it's a very, very tricky thing to even find them, but would require testing everyone. And then when you do find somebody positive, to follow them all up, follow everything up with that person, find out who their contacts are and see if if any of their contacts got sick. So that's what you'd have to do. It would require a lot of work. I don't think we're doing that.
I believe they were doing that at the fishery over there in Newport. They contacted all kinds of folks real quick.
CBC.
Let's see, Mike. I got you checked in here. CPC. Yes, K4CPC. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, sorry about that. I didn't check in. That was a whole busload of workers that Dominique brought in on there. And they all stayed in one motel, so it's close quarters, close work, and not a typical situation.
Okay, yeah, so that's a sort of a separate topic we're going to talk a little bit about. You know, so what's interesting also about our numbers, when you start looking at numbers that you see, you know, coronavirus infections in Oregon, you know, right now, one of the headlines I have here on the Oregon Live is infections in Oregon hit all-time high. Okay, it looks like our trend is going up, you know, on our reported cases. You know, it's we're actually higher than we were back in April. So if you look at the current identified coronavirus infections. Now, we didn't have a lot of cases in the first place, okay? The fact that we've got all of a sudden, you know, a bunch of new cases, it really is bringing our moving average up. So if you want to look at your favorite, whatever your favorite graphic is of this. Now, what we're seeing is that there are clusters, as a, you know, of cases that are coming out of places like this, you know, it says Newport Pacific Seafood tested, infected at least 124 people. But that represents every five Oregonians identified within the past week. Okay, so you got one spot where it's basically one-fifth of all of the identified cases were in just one spot, okay? So, now, the question you have to ask yourself is, you know, where are those people? They're all, you know, obviously they're in a work situation where they're not socially distant and they're more likely to spread it. You know, just like a meat packing plant, you're working together in cold rooms and things like that, and people are coming in from all over to work. So, you know, it's community. I don't know that they caught it from going to work. They might have, somebody brought it into work. But we talked about last week that there are people that they find that seem to be super spreaders, where their infectivity is going much more quicker than what we would think would happen. And so, yeah, a super spreader that came in, we don't know whether that super spreader would be called pre-infective or asymptomatic. So pre-infective is that they're not sick yet, but they will be sick in a couple days. You know, asymptomatic is we don't know what the numbers are. But the point is, all of a sudden, you get a whole bunch of people, a whole cluster of cases. It really throws your numbers off for the week. So once again, we don't test enough people to know what is the real number of people. But we know it's that in certain situations like this seafood plant, you can get a big number. So comments on that. I heard Richard in there. Was somebody else maybe doubled with you? Who else was in there?
Whiskey 7, Mike Tango Lima.
Okay, there's Craig. Whiskey 7, Mike Tango Lima. Did you have a comment too, Craig, or are you just checking in?
Yeah, I had a comment.
Okay, so let's hear from Richard first, and then we'll go to Craig. And Richard, if you're recording this, I'll go ahead and repeat the question when you give it. Yeah, so, okay, so Richard mentioned that increased testing might lead to increased spiking, and that's true. We should be testing in institutions. We know that there seem to be certain hotspot places that are you know, we're finding out these meat packing plants and things. We get large numbers of people. Now, I don't know. I haven't read enough about them to see, you know, how many people actually reported sick or out of the groups that were tested positive. You know, that's the thing is that it says here at the Pacific Seafood, it says nearly all those infections are among people who are tested without symptoms. So, you know, so yes, you can get more, you find more people when you test more. And we hope that the, you know, these, that when we test in the workplace, which we are trying to, you know, we'll do something about that data. We're not just going to send them home. We're going to then go and do the contact tracing on the outbreak. That is the strategy. So what we want to do is make sure that if we can find, you know, by testing infected people and then contact trace and watch those people they were around and get them out of the workplace, that them will stop the chain of transmission, you know. So, but we know that there are certain situations, you know, that they mentioned also in the news about bunk beds that among farm workers. Farm workers seem to be testing, you know, more frequently positive than the general population, but they live in, migrant farm workers live in bunkhouses with bunk beds. Well, that's a lot of people in a small room, all unrelated, you know, working together. And so, you know, that is not a good behavior if you want to keep the infections down. So can we do something about that now that we know that's the case? Yes, you can, you know. But that's the kind of, we have to have a way of finding out where the problem spots are and then making some changes to, and certainly not ignoring it. Any other comments?
KE7OOU with a comment.
Okay, so Paul, I kind of put you number two. Craig had a comment there.
Yeah, I just comment on. I heard there's three food processing outfits in Oregon that had outbreaks. One of them was the Pacific Seafoods in Lincoln County, you mentioned. Then I heard there's also one in Forest Grove and Bob's Red Mill, which is in Clackamas or Milwaukee, are the three I heard about. And that's all I wanted to comment on. W7MT.
Yep, so we're finding these more, but we are letting these businesses work. So, you know, I think you would consider all these food places to have, we didn't quite use the essential business thing that some of the other states did, but these have all been essential operations because they're food handler people, and we need food. So they've not, you know, been shut down. They've been working all the way through this. So you have to ask your question, well, is this just because, you know, we have bad working conditions that encourage the spread of this, or is this the fact that these people have not quarantined? They continue to go to work. They continue to, you know, be out there. Where, you know, the quarantining part works. The self-quarantining, we know that works. You know, so, but if you have to go to work, you know, you obviously are exposing yourself, you know, to large numbers of people and traveling back and forth and your families and what have you. So that may be just that they're out there more, that they've had more exposure. They have not self-isolated like we have. Okay, OLU, your comment.
KE7OLU. Part of the issue is with the larger number of testing, if you have the same test with the same number of false positives and the same number of false negatives, and you do more testing, and it's the same population that you're testing, then your testing percentage of people found positive will be the same even if you're doing more testing. If the test that you're using in the past is different than the test you're using now, then you don't know whether the change in rate is a result of a different population, i.e. more or fewer people are truly in the population are truly sick or not, or whether it's an artifice of the test. And I suspect part of the problem is that we are now getting the use of the test calibrated better so that we know whether it's an artifice of the test or not, but we are now starting to test different populations than we used to because of the testing qualifications. In the past, you had to be sick and have open symptoms, fairly severe symptoms, actually, to be tested. The testing was a way to get into the hospital. Now they're testing more widely, if you will, slightly more randomly than they used to, and so we will find different test positive rates that are truly an effect of both the testing procedure and the population that you're testing. KE7OA, you back to net.
Okay, yep, very good. Well, there is a, yeah, there, the thing is that you brought up some really good points there about, you know, the testing. So we talked about that originally. That was one of the complaints that Sheila figured out immediately, was that we were not, you know, testing like we would like to test. We were testing only people that had met certain criteria, because basically some of our decisions were based on availability of supplies, and, you know, that was nationwide, you know, that we didn't have enough supplies, so who are you going to test? So let's test the most likely, you know, people that we think were risky, like those people who visited China, or those people who were on a cruise ship, or those people, well, who were in a hospital and they seemed to have the symptoms and they were pretty sick, you know. So those are the people. Initially, they didn't even check people that came to the hospital who weren't sick enough to be admitted but had symptoms. So now we know that their symptoms vary widely, that asymptomatic people can test positive. We have developed new kinds of testing, a rapid testing versus the nasal swab with the PCR test, which is sort of the standard for testing. We have, we changed the criterion and we changed the testing method. So now it's very difficult to tell old data versus new data. That it's more of a political decision or decision by epidemiologists as to what they want to do with the testing. But what we really want to do is what is the next action point? What do we want to do with our results? You know, if we start making it so that we don't believe the results, then we're going to say, well, we just don't know, and we give up. You know, that's not right. Let me get a drip. What we do know by testing and finding people is that it's still out there. It didn't go away. What went away was our behavior, which, you know, led to the rapid spread of the virus. Okay, so now we're going to bring back that behavior slowly over in two-week increments. We're going to say, okay, well, let's open this up and let's try this. And we'll see how bad it gets. And what we'll probably find out is, yes, it's going to go back up, but if then the idea is to test to try to see how well we're doing, and we find out, oh, yeah, well, look, these particular places, this is what we found now. These food workers, those guys never would have been tested in the past. You know, they don't have any symptoms, and they're not from, they didn't go anywhere. They didn't have any relatives, that were sick. They didn't go to China. You know, we don't know about them. Well, now we have tests, so we can go test them. And we're finding that they're, that sort of sampling, at-risk places are showing higher numbers of positives. So, yeah, what do you do with that information? You go after, you know, you have to test them again. You have to do work on them to try to make sure that those people are not spreading it further and we're ignoring them. That's about all I can say about that. But it's not up to us as emergency preparedness people to make a decision. We just have to decide, do we want to continue to do what we're doing, and what risk do we want to take when we go out there, knowing that there are still people out there that are sick or have the illness, whether they're sick or not. They are still carriers of the virus. Yes, sir, Richard, and again, I'll repeat your comment there. Right, so again, this is the specialty, this epidemiology stuff. You know, this is the thing that we're learning now. We're about, the only data we have now is that we're doing this expansive testing. So how do you interpret it, right? And they're going to have to figure out how to adjust this. And what we're finding is that when we throw, you know, certain groups together, we can really screw up the data. You know, the one number that Sheila said to watch out for, which is on actually on this Oregon Live update, it has a picture of hospitalization in Oregon. Now, that one is the one to keep your eye on if you really want to see what's happening there. Now, what we're seeing is that our deaths are very low. We're just, you know, not very many people dying. But there does seem to be an uptick from the 31st through now in the numbers of hospitalized patients. And she said this is the one that you want to watch because those are the sickest people with this illness. And that's the number that was high before, what we were worried about, filling up hospitals and breaking the system. That's what we were worried about. So when we see that number start to rise, it means that, you know, there is, you know, the virus is still increasing because that's a small percentage of the overall number of people. We don't know what that number really is, but we have no influence over that. We can't, you know, we're not turning people away. There's room. We're not hospitalizing people if they don't need it. So that one should be a comparable number for you. Okay, any other comments? This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo at 731. We are on Emergency Preparedness Net. We're still talking about, you know, COVID, which has not gone away.
Whiskey 7, Sierra Hotel Mike, checking in.
Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango with the check-in and a question.
Golf 7, Oscar Golf, kick in.
Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar X-ray, check in.
Check it in.
Okay, pause there for just a second because we had a double with GA there. We had Alpha Golf 7, Oscar Golf, Doug. Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar X-ray, GA. Might have been Ben in there. Come back with who didn't I hear?
Kilo Juliet 7, India Bravo Hotel.
Oh, that's Gerard. Yeah, welcome, Gerard. Kilo Juliet 7, India Bravo Hotel. And let's see, Steve, Whiskey 7, Sierra Hotel Mike. See, I had checked in before. Did you have a comment?
No comment, but I didn't get an acknowledgement on my check-in earlier.
Oh, I apologize. I guess they just overwhelmed my brain there. It was you're up at the top there on the list. If I skipped you, I apologize for that. Thank you again for checking in. Your signal sounds good. Everybody's signal sounds good tonight. So, anyway, let's see. Watch the hospitalization number. You know, ultimately, we have to make our own decisions about what risks that we want to take. And it's interesting, there was an article that came out, I think it was New York Times yesterday. They had done a survey of epidemiologists and people who study these viruses, and they said, well, when would you think you could go back to normal? When personally, you know, what's your personal opinion? What are you going to do about changing your behaviors? And when would you go back to doing these different activities? And a whole bunch of different activities, of which we all want to do. And, you know, I don't know if anybody saw that article or I can tell you a little bit just briefly, but does anybody see that about the what the experts would do given a choice of when they would go back to normal?
I think they were going to make back to normal after they got the vaccine, Kasich.
The main comment was that it's not a time-dependent thing. They said they objected a little bit to the questionnaire because they said, you know, in the next 2 months, which activities would you resume doing and things like that. They said it doesn't work that way. It works. We don't know. Some people said that they'd never go back to going to like shaking hands again because they didn't like that idea in the first place. You know, they've just as soon not shake hands with people and spread germs by hand-to-hand contact. Most people, I think that the ones that we've identified as being the bigger risky things, like huge numbers of people in closed spaces, concerts and sports events and things like that, they all would not do, not for a long time. You know, as far as like other things like sending their kids back to school, they were more, larger numbers of people were in favor of doing that because they felt that the risk of, that spoiling the education of the child, you know, since children don't get infected quite as much, though they can have consequences, that they would have to weigh the consequences of a poor education and falling behind in school versus the risk of, of the COVID infection. So they were more likely to send their kids back to school in September, a larger number of people. There was no real majority opinion on any of them. They were all kind of in the 40% would do it, 40% would not do it kind of range on a bunch of different questions. But, none of them really said that we could just, it's a time thing. And does that make sense to people that it's, think about it. Not much, really, time has passed since we first started having the problem and first did something about it in March. Okay, we all hid, and that works. Okay, and now we're coming out of the burrow, and we're looking around, and it's still there. Okay, so, what has happened in a couple of months that would change our behavior? And I can think of a couple things. Testing is more widespread availability. Testing is one of them. Okay, new evidence about, who's infected and who's not. Wants you to want to dive back in the hole again a little bit. But does anybody else know of anything they'd like to bring up about what do you think has happened in the last couple months that has changed that would say that it's just a time thing?
SRX.
OAU.
Okay, a bit of a double there. I got OLU. And who else was in there?
KA7SOX.
Jay, let's hear Paul first because he won the double, and then we'll hear your comment there. Go ahead, Paul.
There's been an article came out that they think possibly that blood cholesterol is a factor, and that they're finding out. Correction, that it was a cholesterol issue, but not the kind of blood cholesterol that shows up in a test. Could you explain any of the findings in that area? KE7OLU, back to Dan.
Okay, so now again, I don't know the study. As we're finding out, as we look backwards on people, we're saying, geez, we're finding all of these groups of people who you're starting to hear reports about that, yeah, they seem to have higher rates of infection and we don't really understand it. We always said underlying health conditions, in kind of a general sense, are more at risk, right? And, know, there was a report today that said that, that people with developmental disabilities had higher rates of infection. You know, they've said that there's a race factor in there, that Latinos and blacks have seem to be more affected. Okay, and pinning it down to which is the factors that makes it worse, you know, requires some study. But the point is that, yeah, we're starting to see data that, yeah, it doesn't seem to be just a random thing throughout the population. But we never kind of thought that would be the case. But every time if we generalize and say, oh, well, yeah, it's just those, you know, those old people or those people in nursing homes or those people who, you know, have high cholesterol or whatever that are dying from this, you know, it tends to, you know, say, well, I don't have that, you know. I think it might be not a service to people to make them feel like, well, I don't fit into that group, so I don't have to worry about it. I don't know that we, you know, individually can take it, an individual person, and say, what is your risk? You know, and you have to adjust that for yourself. If you know that you have an underlying health condition, whatever that is, you know, you're going to have a tougher time if you get COVID. So if you do, you know, I know Mike has said he's extremely precautious up there, and doesn't, you know, and he has the right to be. He's cautious of his health anyway, even without the virus, and that's fine. That's a good way to be. But yeah, what we'll find, we're going to find more and more evidence that there are certain conditions will make you more at risk. But then the question is, what do you do if you do have that condition? You know, that's the next step. Okay. Let's see. Let's get, who was it? Was it Jay in there? Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, you know, I obviously have talked to a lot of people about this, and one of the main concerns that I have and they have is that, you know, our government has come up with rules and regulations based on, you know, the knowledge that they had at the time. But in a lot of cases, that knowledge was turned out to be wrong. I mean, they told everybody to, oh, stay home, don't go out. Now they find out that, well, staying at home is probably the worst thing that happened. You know, there's more infection and people clustered together for a long period of time. In New York, they had, you know, the governor said to people that older people, you know, go to a nursing home where you can get care. Well, it turned out that infected all the people in the nursing home. So the rules and regulations vary back and forth and change with the times. But I'm concerned that the government's trying to act prematurely and not getting all of the facts before they act. And, you know, they're in California, you're not allowed on the beach. Well, it turns out now that being outdoors is probably one of the best places to be. So, you know, and the numbers keep changing and the statistics change, and I understand that, but it's a brand new virus. But it seems to me that we should throttle back our controls on people until we understand what the problem is. Back to Ned.
Yep, KG7GDB. So getting a little bit into the political, we can't really do much about that in terms of, except that, you know, we know what works, okay? And we're seeing that, we know now the kinds of conditions. What we're finding now out now, it seems like, is, hey, these are bad places. This is bad kind of behavior. These people were getting a lot more cases in those nursing homes, those prisons, those factories. And, yes, they can't do social distancing in those. And the people that have to go to work, they're more at risk than people who stay home. So, but, yes, if you're, you know, there was the thing about the group homes for the, you know, developmentally disabled people, that they live in group homes, and they are more, you know, unrelated people living together in large numbers, and they, you know, they're social, and they eat together, and they, you know, are more likely to spread it. There always was indication that things spread very rapidly, you know, in person-to-person local family settings. There's always was That's why they always say, well, you got to do the contact tracing and test all of your family members, okay? That was known from the beginning. But as far as, you know, we know now the distance part and, the fact that there seems to be, you know, an aerosol spread, they didn't tell us that at the beginning. They said, oh, no. The only way you can get it is if someone coughs on you or something, you know. They also said that, you got to watch out for fever because you're going to get a fever and a cough first thing. That'll notice that. And then, you know, that changed. Well, that would have been nice if they'd said, well, you know, no, you can pass the disease on even if you don't show any symptoms. That might have changed our behavior a bit. So, you know, we'll look through the looking glass, but the point is that we did stuff at the beginning, and I think there was a study that came out we're talking about today that they have kind of projected what would have happened had we not done what we did, how many more deaths there would have been, and it's a pretty significant number of how many more cases and deaths had we not shut down. So I don't know if you saw that article, but they're trying to, you know, show us that they actually are modeling, well, what if we hadn't done this, that kind of questions.
KE7, OLU, the copy.
Well, it would be interesting to see what how they formulated that. That would be a tough statistical thing. But as a little bit more humorous side, with all the riots going on, people were saying, well, you know, are more and more people going to get infected because obviously the people doing the rioting are not practicing social distancing. And it turned out the numbers didn't change at all. And so I heard somebody on the so-called expert on the news today, and he said, well, the reason that the numbers didn't go up is the areas where they had the rioting, they'd closed down all of the testing. So obviously the numbers didn't go up.
W7NAT.
Let's see. Was Paul in there? I think Paul had a comment, and then Dan. Then we'll do Nate. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo for ID. We have the emergency preparedness in. I think it's Paul first.
KE7OLU. Some of the issues that you're confounding variables, for instance, with the beach closures, it wasn't that people were going to catch the infection at the beach. It's that if something happened at the beach with an infected person, that was taking someone from the emergency response system in order to deal with them. If they were traveling from some place that had good hospital care to an isolated beach area that did not have a high good coverage, didn't have good hospital care, then you were creating a problem for a community that would have not normally had it. So they shut down the beaches, not because the beaches were a place that was going to be high risk. It was because of if you got even a small number of cases brought from somewhere else to the beach, you are going to increase the problem by a large order of magnitude than if you were able to control where the virus spread was. KE7OLU, back to Dan.
Okay, very good. Nate, you got a comment?
Yeah, Paul pretty well covered it on the beach. You have to be careful that you do have the 6 foot, the distance should be there, because if somebody did come along and they coughed right at you close by, you're probably going to get it.
But two surfers out in the water are not going to infect each other. It's that if one of them has brought the infection from someplace else and then infects a rather isolated place with poor medical facilities is the real problem of people going to the beach. Not that they're going to spread it to each other on the beach, that they're bringing it from somewhere else to the beach. KE7OLU.
Yeah, KG7 GDB. So again, we know what the risks are. We've talked about still social distancing, and you know, obviously the beach being a breezy place is a easy place to do social distancing. The question is, it's just like, you know, camping. You know, you can go camping with your family that you've been with all along, and maybe people talk about bringing people into your what's the term for it? Anyway, into your friends group, that there are other people who are behaving the same way you have. They've been keeping social distance. Nobody's been sick. You know, they're not. And, you know, you might want to go camping with them, you know. But every time that you bring new people in, like you're saying, from that are not related, and you don't know the background of how those people have behaved, whether they're one of these meat packing plant workers or seafood workers, and they all come, you know, in, and they're asymptomatic, or they might, you know, and they're all, you know, sitting shoulder to shoulder around the big bonfire and sharing bottles of beer back and forth. You know, that's more risky than sitting, you know, than jogging along the beach and flying a kite. Because I think it's the behavior, you know, California beaches are very crowded, by the way. It's sometimes so difficult to get 6 feet apart. They're, you know, walking around, difficult to walk around all the towels that are spread so close together. So, better that it's outdoors, but we know what the behavior is that to be avoided. That's the sitting in near unrelated people that you don't know the background of for periods of time without having any kind of mask, and, you know, obviously it'd be worse if it were indoors. KG7, GDB. Okay, so, anyway, I guess what we'll do is we're still going to be in a holding pattern as far as the, you know, what's new. When things start coming down to some of the new treatments or the vaccine possibilities, if people questions about the sort of the medical aspects of this stuff, or, you know, if any new tests or treatments come out, we'll take a look. But the one that we should really kind of keep an eye on, I think everybody can kind of look at, is hospitalizations, especially at Marion County, if they, you know, have that data for us. Take a look at county data for our hospitalizations if you're here, because Marion County is one of the, you know, the places that test the least, you know, and Oregon tests the least, and we seem to have low numbers, but per capita, we're actually pretty high. So, you know, Marion County with a lower population, we have similar cases per capita compared to Multnomah County, which has a lot more people. So, you know, then you start asking, why is that? Well, you know, that's up to them to figure out, and what we can do something about it. If it's bunk beds in the farm workers, that get rid of that, maybe that'll help us. But take a look at those hospitalizations. KG7, GDB. So, see, any other COVID comments? Because I wanted to go on. We have a project going right now with our ARES group about emergency communications, and I wanted to bring that up to the group. Okay, so the other thing that's been happening, and Paul can tell us too, that we have one of our members, Al, who lives in Kaiser, decided that what we needed was he got this idea from Colorado. You can a reference card to put in our Go kits. Now, everybody should know what a Go kit is. It listens to the Emergency Preparedness Net, right? You've got you know, some supplies set aside, and since we're talking about radio right now, you got your radio, okay? We assume you got a radio, you got some kind of extra batteries for the radio, you know how to use the thing, or you have some kind of reference to, you know, how to program it or you know, work the darn thing, or you practice with it all the time like we do, you know, and you get to use that radio. But who are you going to call, as the old Ghostbusters thing went, right? So Al said we should put our essential information for doing emergency communications on a 4x6 laminated card and then make that available to everyone that wants one, that works with the various MCOM groups. And that way we'd have information that we could have if we in our Go kit. So when we're away from our official duties and, you know, working at the EOC or something, we can still make contacts and be effective. All right, so he's put together a card so far, and he's asking for some suggestions as to what information would you like to have on that card, okay? So, Paul, do you want to, I mean, we've made some progress, it's like on version 5, but I did see he said I'd bring it up to the group, and we can talk a little bit about what's on the card, but what would you like to see on a card? So, Paul, can you tell us first what we've done and what kind of input do you think we might be able to get from this group?
KE7OLU, I have to plead ignorance and lack of work. I've been dealing with child care here and have had limited time to deal with that, so I have no opinion other than I applaud the work that people are doing. KE7OLU, back to Ben.
Okay, so let's see. I think Dan might still be listening. He looked at it. Tim hasn't checked in. I looked at it a little bit. I mean, we're all busy doing different things. I guess Al decided that he really thought we shouldn't, and I guess it's a good point. We can't just think that the only thing going on is COVID-19 and that, you know, we want to use our radios. You know, the question is, would it be a good idea? He thought it would be a good idea to have a 4x6, card, print out a bunch of information on it, and I'll give you some examples of what he's got on there so far. Use both sides, maybe laminate it so it doesn't get messed up, and stick it in with your GoKit, supplies and radio. Now he's thinking first about Marion County, so if you're in a different county, you may have experience with this. First of all, does anybody have something like that that they put in their GoKit, a reference, what we call an MCOM kit, or some people call it a field operator's guide, a FOG.
KE7OLU.
Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
I have in my GoKit copies of other versions of the same thing that Al's doing. I use the National Interoperability Guide. I also use the statewide communications guide, field operating guide, that has been put out by a statewide group. Steve Dowell has been a prime mover on that, that has the official frequencies for each of the county agencies. There have been a number of others. Doug Simmons has put together something in about 2009-10, copies of that. So I have copies of probably 6 to 10 different versions of the same thing that Al has been doing, that are some of them old and obsolete now. Frequencies are not being used, and I applaud him for reviving this and validating which ones are currently useful. KE7OLU, back to net.
Okay, very good. So, yes, that's the same thing here. I mean, people had one of these. I think I have one dated 2011, but the problem is that over time, some things change, and so the wrong frequency doesn't help you very much if you're out there and that's what you're trying to look up. So remember, we're trying is a situation where maybe our cell phone, we're going to save its precious battery. Internet may not be available. We need to know who to contact. So this is just basically kind of also bringing it more locally, okay? Having a statewide guide doesn't do us any good if our GoKit has, a 2-meter radio on it, necessarily. It depends on what we're going to bring with us. But this is where, we're trying to get some information. So if you're, for example, if you're a CERT member, you might have a radio which has been issued to you, in Marion County, which has some of the public service frequencies on it, okay? The VTACs and UTAC frequencies. And so in exercises with CERT, oftentimes they'll say, okay, yeah, go, they have a net, for example, that they check in using a VTAC frequency. Other people I think of, you know, CERT again in Salem, you know, has a simplex net that they do on the first Sunday of the month, and that's one I never seem to be able to remember which that frequency is on simplex. There are, on the other hand, there are some frequencies that we always use, that we, you know, there's some that you may already know. There's national calling frequencies for simplex on 70 centimeters and 2 meters and 6 meters, 10 meters, you know, all of them have national calling frequencies. What we do with HF, we almost always need to use our statewide HF frequencies. Those are listed on there. But one of the things is that, what about counties? Now, when he first put, if you're working in a county, if you're working in Marion County, for example, you'd think, oh, well, which county information? Do I just need my county or do I need another county, right? So somebody who's in Aries or Oxcom that might answer the question differently from a person who's just generally interested. Who do you want to contact? What do you want to just contact people in your county or another county? What do you think?
KE7OLU.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yesterday I received an email from Krista Roland Carter at Marion County Emergency Management requesting that all of the Marion County CERT groups return any radios that had been issued to them by Marion County, that the frequencies that were programming into those radios were no longer valid, and that they needed the equipment back in order to get a the correct frequencies and a uniform group of frequencies in it, standardized. Part of the problem was that as the radios were issued over time, frequencies were added or subtracted, and that the radios were not the same. Some radios had authorized frequencies in them. Other radios did not have some of the frequencies. So the request was to return all Marion County issued radios to Krista Carter Roland at Marion County Emergency Management. Back to that, KU7OU.
Okay, so, yeah, I didn't, as a CERT member, didn't receive that, but maybe, you know, I don't, again, know how they expect us to know that if they don't contact us. But this is another issue, is, okay, if you pre-program a radio, that's great until the radio gets you know, the programming gets changed. And so, you know, as ham radio operators, we're sort of in a unique position here, so we can, you know, we can use our frequencies that are assigned to us, and we're really the only people who can use ham radio frequencies, all right? So, and most of us who do volunteer work as far as emergency auxiliary communications, you know, have put together plans. There are plans for, you know, that we can get, particularly they have the Benton County Aries group has always kept a big spreadsheet of all of the contact numbers of the different counties, okay? So the first thing I looked at is he had Marion and Polk County, but it turns out each county, we know this, actually needs to be, we have agreements with all the adjacent counties. So the first thing you might ask yourself is, who are my adjacent counties, whatever county you're living in, okay? Because those are the numbers that you probably are most likely to need with VHF and UHF, is your adjacent counties, all right? And often our exercises are involved with, can you contact all your adjacent counties and deliver a message to them? Because they're the ones who are going to help you, you know, with mutual aid. You know, your Harney County isn't going to come help, you know, Yamhill County, not immediately. And, you know, even though they might be available to do some HF relaying or something like that, they're not your primary people that you're going to contact. You're going to contact, you know, in Yamhill County, you're going to contact Washington County, and you're going to contact, you know, Marion County and, you know, Clackamas County. You're going to look at your adjacent counties. So that's the first thing, is I thought we need to know your adjacent counties and have contact information for them. So, who, if you're out there now, again, your Oxcom people may have a different thing, but if you're just sort of, we're running out of time here, but if you're out in the field and you wanted to help, what number would you think would be helpful to you to have written down on a card, because we're going to try to put them on the card, to remember that you can't normally remember. If you were out there and you had your GoKit radio and you needed to bug out and go to a different location and operate your radio for, you know, in an emergency, what numbers or frequencies or information would you like to see on the card? I'll just take some suggestions as quick as we can. I'll write them down, and we won't go too long on this. Go ahead, KG7GDB.
So, you comment.
Sorry, it was a little quick key there. I didn't hear the first part. Go ahead.
KE7OLU with a comment. Like we teach in the CERT basic class, that you personally, your family, needs an out-of-area contact, a person who is not affected by the emergency, that can, in this clean, dry, warm, safe area, unaffected, can receive and relay information. Similar with the HF situation, you need an out-of-area HF station that can act as a relay station, as a hold and forward information, that if you have information, you send it to them, they would hold it until somebody that needs that information checks it, and then forwards that information on, similar to the CERT personal family preparedness out of area contact. KE7OLU back.
Okay, good suggestions there. So not just the, you know, we'll probably print the card with sort of the state frequencies for HF, but we might want something else on there. I suggested that we need a little blank spot for personalization, you know, and that's a very good idea for having your out-of-state contact, a place to write down whoever that is on your particular card. But to get the ball rolling so that people have at least the basic information, that's, again, more kind of looking at which contact numbers or frequencies would you like to see on your card.
A peacock, KJ798.
Yeah, go ahead. I didn't catch the call, but go ahead with your comment there, coming in with the call.
You said that what would we put on our QSL cards?
No, clarification. So what we're looking at is, okay, you've got a radio supposedly you're going to use for emergencies, right? You're going to put it in a bag, and you're going to stick something in the bag with it, a little card of information that will help you get in contact with whoever you need to get in contact with that radio, because it may or may not be programmed into your radio. Okay, so we're looking for ideas from people as to what information you would like to see on that card, because we're going to try to print these things up and make them available to people so that, you know, we can pass out this information. Is that clear?
Yeah, it is now. Yeah, I was laying here half asleep, so it's time for me to wake up and listen.
Okay, so anyway, obviously we have things like this frequency of the 14529 and, you know, the 14519 with tone 100, you know, as those are the primary Marion County repeaters that are used for by the Oxcom group, so primary and a secondary. So usually we have two repeaters for each county that are the primary and secondary repeaters that are used. There are other repeaters, and Nate can tell you that we have the LDS group has their system of repeaters, and the 14706 is a repeater they use for emergency preparedness. And again, that's a if one repeater gets tied up, you need another repeater to go to. So they have secondary repeaters. So those kind of things we actually have on there. You know, there might be simplex frequencies that are in use. Those are the ones I can never remember. So if we have a certain simplex frequency for Salem, that might be different. But we, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know whether CERT would want to contact anybody other than their own county. That's one question. Or whether you would want to contact anybody in CERT. You know, for example, if you're not a member of CERT, CERT people can certainly help save you if there's no one else around. That's what their job is, to save their neighborhood, right? So how do you get in contact with them? So anyway, I suggested some, you know, some contact numbers, cell phone numbers of people who are leaders in the different groups for your local area on the back. That was one of my suggestions. But if anybody else has any ideas, I don't want to spend all night because it's actually almost 10 after here. So, but we are looking for ideas for that group. If you have any, you can email them to wa7abu at arrl.net or to me, Kilo Golf 7 Golf Build Bravo at arrl.net. And we'll pass along to people that are working on the project. Or you can put it on our group's IO, wa7abugroup.io there. You know, put suggestions of things that you would like to see on the card if you think about that. But I think anybody else have any final words there? Because I got to close the net down. We can talk about it again next week. Okay, very good. Well, good discussion tonight. Thank you for everyone. The time is now 8:10, and this concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. Let's see, I think there'll be recording available today's discussion on the wa7abu.groups.io page. And you can reach it, you know, if you're a member. I hope you're a member of groups.io, and, you know, wa7abu should be there as a membership for you. And then you can look at the files section there and get recordings from this and other emergency preparedness nets that we've had. Again, we meet every Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. on 145.29 megahertz. Our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of this repeater. Thank you to all who participated tonight and those who stood by to give us a clear channel. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf, Delta Bravo, now closing the net at 8:11 p.m. We now return the repeater to normal undirected amateur operator operations. KG7GDB, I'll be clear and standing by.